The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
I'm just honored and delighted to be here. This event came about almost accidentally. I got a letter from the college and from the church about the archaeological exhibit. And somehow the archaeological exhibit and the Celtic throne and then my speaking sort of all fell together. And it's been just a jam-packed day and a lot of fun. In fact, I'm thinking I'm not leaving.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to leave later today. Dinesh D'Souza, our featured speaker last night at Armstrong Auditorium, he'll be heading back home, but not until he pays us a visit here at the Trumpet Daily. So a very special edition of the Trumpet Daily today. You can get to the live video stream of this show at trumpetdaily.com or over at the Rumble channel, rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. Mr. D'Souza, glad to have you with us again.
Thank you. Good to be here and looking forward to this.
Well, I say again because he was generous enough with his time to give us a pre-recorded segment where the focus was on two of his books from 2010 and 2012, The Roots of Obama's Rage, and then Obama's America. And of course, he also made a film back at that time on that subject as well. We're probably going to play that for you on Wednesday's show. And to start with on today's show, just to button that up a little bit further, you had, I believe this was from a podcast you gave in August, so a few months ago, where you were talking, you were comparing, is it David Garrow's book, his biography on Obama, with just some of the things that you have concluded over the years. And maybe we can start with a clip from your podcast. This is clip 3.
Part of his argument is that Obama really is a guy who makes up his own past. He fictionalizes his own history. And so you can't trust the book Dreams from My Father, which was Obama's. Well, that was Obama's own, The Making of Barack Obama. Now, I read that book very carefully. In fact, I saw in that book a series of ideological formations and commitments completely different from what the media was saying about Obama.
And one of the things you pointed out in the pre-recorded segment that we had was how that Obama's DOJ came after you so aggressively because you exposed him as a fraud.
Yeah, the point about fictionalizing the past, to some degree, all politicians create a sort of storyline about themselves. And the storyline typically has elements of truth, but also some embellishment. I mean, in some degree, this is even true of Lincoln with his log. And I was raised in a log cabin. That might have been true of Lincoln at one point in his life. But that was, if you had a full understanding of Lincoln's childhood, it wasn't all that. He wasn't like growing up in a log cabin. And but it was a way of Lincoln saying, I'm an ordinary man, you know. And with Obama, he has spun his story in a way that makes him the quintessential American, even though his real story, he's the quintessential anti-American.
Yeah. You definitely want to see the show on Wednesday. We go into a lot of detail. I don't want to rehash everything. But you made some really good points in that podcast from a few months ago. Just to play a couple more before we move on. Try clip 4.
And look, the relevance of this is that Obama is still, he's still got his fingers in the pie. First of all, he lives in Washington, D.C. Kind of odd, right? Here's a guy, he served 2 terms. You think he would go someplace else, live out the rest of his life. No, he wants to run things. He said on video not very long ago that he wouldn't mind a 3rd term. He doesn't necessarily want to serve it himself, but he wouldn't mind whispering into the ear of somebody else who would carry out his orders. Maybe that's what he's doing now.
You refer there to a soundbite that we've probably played a couple dozen times on this show, where he talked about the earpiece and being in the basement and the sweats and that sort of thing. And again, we touched on this in the previous segment. But you went on to say he lives in D.C. and there's no stakeouts around his house. Like, you would think if there was a curious reporter that wanted to get, you know, a handle on this interchange between him and Joe Biden, that people would be camped outside of his house. As it is, they don't even cover it.
Exactly. And quite apart from camping out, you think that there would be a kind of attempt to investigate and kind of monitor what are the connections between Obama, the kind of Obama circle of prominent people who served with Obama, who are now serving with Biden. In other words, isn't there a kind of a web going on? And what is Obama's own role in that web? In some ways, I think Obama took Hillary's defeat very personally, because obviously it was partly a referendum on Hillary, but it was also partly a referendum on the Obama years. People were voting against Obama's legacy when they decided to bring in Trump. And so Obama has a great stake in not only his own presidency, but in saving the Obama agenda,
right,
and in moving it forward. And I believe that to a large degree, that is what's happening under Biden.
Yeah. So tell us, again, that gives you a little foretaste of what you can see on the program Wednesday. Tell us a little bit, as we fast forward to today, what projects you've got, a movie you're working on for September. And then there's another movie you're going to be working on next year, which we can talk about later. But tell us a little bit about the project for this year.
Well, it's looking at the very, it's a little difficult to make a movie about what's happening now, because things are rapidly changing and it is almost impossible to predict what's going to happen. So to take two questions, is it possible that Biden will be pulled off the ticket? It's possible. To me, it would require Biden really plummeting in the polls. If Trump is, you know, 15 points ahead, the Democrats are like, there's no pathway to success with this guy. Maybe there would be an effort to intervene. But it's getting late in the day for that to happen. A second question is it possible that Trump will not only be convicted with all the, you know, guilty headlines all over the country and the world, but be incarcerated? So the Republican nominee for president in a democratic society is in jail. That's a possibility. Is it a likelihood? I don't know. But so it is. This is not a normal type of election year where you can just say, all right, I'll capture what's going on, because there's almost no way to know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Next.
I asked you the other day about the cheating, the rampant cheating that happened in 2020, and if they'd be able to pull that off again. You said it would be a lot more difficult to just be so audacious as they were, you know, being filmed doing it in your movie 2000 Mules. But you made the point that one reason we know that they're not just banking on the mules again this time, or at least not to the extent that they did in 2020, is because of how aggressively they're going after Donald Trump, using lawfare and the indictments and all of those things, and trying to, as you say, put him in prison. So you feel like the lawfare is sort of their, is that at the top of their strategy to prevent him from coming back?
Yeah, I think it is, because it is the only kind of guaranteed way.
Yeah.
The other ways are, might work in a close election, but they would not work in a not close election. You can't get homeless votes and nursing home votes and tip. Like, you couldn't have done that to tip Reagan over Carter, or to change the outcome of Reagan versus Mondale, because Reagan won in a landslide. He won 49 states against Mondale. So he obliterated Mondale. And now our elections are not likely to be that close, to be that wide margin anymore. But I do think that the mule strategy worked partly because of COVID,
right,
and partly because Republicans are so sluggish, the Democrats could say, well, I don't think these guys will even wake up to what's happening, at least until much later when you can't do anything about it. But the Democrats are kind of way too smart to replay the exact same strategy. It's kind of like, don't try to rob the bank exactly the same way, because they're going to be looking for that.
Right. Yeah. Tell us about 2,000 mules. That was that last year or year before it?
In 2022,
okay.
2 years ago.
So that comes out, and as we were discussing the other day, you had the leak coming out of the Supreme Court that happened that exact night that your movie was about to premiere. You told me in the previous segment we recorded that you know, that first film you made, Obama's America, that was the most popular one you've produced, right?
Yeah, I think partly it was because it was new. I mean, the conservatives were not making documentary films for the most part. There had been a couple of Christian documentary films, but a political documentary in wide release,
right.
In other words, in hundreds, actually 2,000 theaters, was just a spectacle. And
right.
People were like, wow. Not to mention the fact that the film had a kind of an unexpected angle on Obama, and an angle that required people to scratch their heads and go, huh, well, what is that? You know, Obama is really not so much of a civil rights guy. He's an anti-colonial guy. Well, what's an anti-colonial guy? What does that mean? And so the film becomes an exposition of that. So that film is now the second most successful political documentary after Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11.
Right.
Now, by the time 2000 Mules came out, and that was like my sixth or seventh documentary, the political landscape was now post, well, I mean, 2022 was still in the wake of COVID. So the film, although it opened in theaters, opened in a limited theatrical release. Most people who saw that film did not see it in the theater. They saw it by digital download or streaming or DVDs. So the film had but that was, of my seven films, it would be in terms of the profitability, the success of the film, the number of people who saw it, The Obama's America, number one, 2,000 Mules, number two, although admittedly, several other films have done really well as well.
Right. So 2,000 Mules how do you feel like that's changed just people's perception of what happened in 2020?
Well, I asked the people at the Rasmussen survey to do a survey about 2,000 Mules, essentially asking, A, you know, have you seen the film? B, if you haven't seen it, if you heard about it, C, what do you think about the 2020 election? Was it stolen, yes or no? And so a series of questions kind of like that, and the results are very striking because they show that A, first of all, a lot of people have either seen the film or are familiar with it. They're familiar what it's about and what's in it. Number two, a decisive majority of Republicans and a substantial minority of independents and Democrats all think the 2020 election was stolen. Now, we might argue about, well, was Trump the true winner? But my point is the idea that this was, quote, the most secure election in history, that has been exposed as laughably absurd. No one could actually see this film and go along with that statement. I mean, or if you did, you're a complete idiot.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I've even noticed that they've stopped saying that. That was the big mantra after 2020, but people don't say it anymore because I think they realize how inherently absurd it is.
Oh, yeah. Chris Krebs, he was over, cybersecurity, and he said it was a perfect election. You had all the Georgia officials, Raffensperger, and everyone
exactly.
saying, perfect. This was no flaws whatsoever. So that's been fully exposed as...
Yeah, a couple of them now try to take refuge and back up, and they'll say things like, well, what we really meant to say is that there were no known cyber attacks on the election. But when you say it's the most secure election, that's not what people mean. What people understand that to mean is that there wasn't significant fraud, mm-hmm. or that there wasn't enough cheating to change the outcome of the election. And it's the contention of 2,000 Mules that, A, there was systematic fraud, and while there's room for some disagreement about how much, it is quite possible, indeed probable, that Trump won the 2020 election.
Yeah. You said part of the reason that maybe conservative media weren't quicker, or not even quick, a lot of them just said a few days after the election, let's just move on, we've got to think ahead, we've got to go forward, forget about what's in the past. But that there were some kind of bizarre theories as to how it was stolen, and that you just wanted to stay away from that and just focus on, you know, the location data, the filmings, people on, you know, on video that are actually cramming the drop boxes. So what does that mean? You don't like with the machines and what were some of the other ones you mentioned, you know, the cyber attack and so on. Do you feel like that was for the most part, those other areas were that it was above board and it was mostly the mules, or do you feel like it was kind of a combination of many things?
You know, if I'm not an expert on election fraud in the sense that if I'd been studying the topic for years and True the Vote, which was the organization that was our kind of research or our expert consultants for the movie, they've been at this for 10 years.
Right.
And they will tell you that they think that there's vulnerability in the machines. They will tell you that that there were all kinds of shenanigans that went on. Some of them probable, some of them you can't be sure. So, for example, some of the boarding up of the windows. To this date, we have no plausible explanation for the simultaneous stopping of the count in multiple independent states. They're all supposed to be running their own vote.
Right.
How do they all decide, like within minutes, if not hours of each other, that we're all going to stop the count and pick it up tomorrow morning? That's inherently suspicious. No one has ever given a reasonable explanation for either how or even why that happened. So there are anomalies, but the problem with an anomaly is a conundrum, right? And it leaves you like, huh, I don't know. So I didn't want this film to be a film of maybes and possiblys and this I smell a rat and this is suspicious. I wanted to the film to say, all right, I'm not pretending to know about all types of fraud. I'm going to pick the one type that I think can be definitively established. Mm-hmm. And established by two independent lines of evidence that don't always cross, but when they do cross, they will corroborate each other. So, and those are two lines of evidence that you yourself can be at least to some degree familiar with. If I talk about cell phone geo-tracking, you know, and everybody knows that your phone can be tracked. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go into a field with tall grass and throw your phone, you could then go to another device and search to find your phone, and it'll take you straight to your phone. It won't take you to within 100 feet of your phone, it'll take you to your phone. And so cell phone geo-tracking works. You don't have a murder case in the country today where they don't track the guy's phone. So, in fact, I heard someone talking on TV the other day, and they were talking about criminal cases. They go, listen, these days juries are not even really that into eyewitness evidence. The evidence that they want is DNA, or they want blood evidence, or they want cell phone geo-tracking, or they want surveillance video. And guess what? Cell phone geo-tracking and surveillance video are the two types of evidence we use in 2000 Mules. So they're very credible, and also, to be honest, very cinematic. For someone making a movie, if I say, here's a guy, I got 100 guys who signed affidavits, to a moviegoer, that means nothing. Who are those guys? What are their affidavits? How do we verify all? So it would take you weeks, if not months, to figure that stuff out. On the other hand, if I say, well, this official footage was taken by the state of Georgia. Right. Now let's watch this guy pull up at 3 a.m. in the morning, jump out of his car, look around suspiciously. He's got a backpack evidently full of ballots. Well, I mean, you can see for yourself. You're at the scene of the crime.
Yeah. We've pointed out on this show how that you were ridiculed a bit for the geo-tracking. Well, it's not reliable. You can't really get, you know, a read on where they are exactly. And then here the DOJ and the biggest investigation they've ever unleashed on the January 6 protesters. They're using the geo-tracking technology to try to find out who was where, who went into the Capitol, that sort of thing. You're basically relying on some of the same technology, right?
Right. If you look at these charging documents, they don't just say, oh, well, you know what, this guy showed up in the general vicinity of the Capitol. They say he was 10 feet inside the door. So in other words, they're trying to show he wasn't just outside the building, he was in the building. Right. And they use his phone to try to pinpoint where he was.
Yeah.
And this is extremely reliable technology, obviously getting better by the day. And when you're talking about drop boxes, it's not even, you don't even need a precision of 10 feet because the drop boxes are scattered all over the place. So if I can show that you were, let's say, within 50 feet of 8 different drop boxes on a kind of mailman style route that you went. You'd be hard pressed to give me an explanation for why you did that. Why does your phone move at a steady pace? We're obviously driving. Stop at a Dropbox, stay there for 5 minutes, whatever, move on to the next one, stop, and then keep going. I mean, what is the explanation for that? It doesn't matter whether you are, again, 5, 10, 15, or 50 feet away. Why are you following the Dropbox route?
What kind of reaction did you, or what kind of resistance did you face? You know, we talked in the previous segment about just how Obama's DOJ went after you viciously following your film in 2012. Did you get that same kind of resistance as you were coming into 2000 Mules?
Well, with 2000 Mules, there was a supreme effort to discredit the film. You know, you probably heard about Bill Barr dismissing the film. These are not people who have serious points to make. In other words, it's not that Bill Barr is offering any kind of critique of the film. Absolutely not. His main tool of derision was just like chuckling, ha 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 ha. But that really won't do. If anyone has seen the film, you realize there's just enough there that you can't write it off like that. That's just not going to work.
Right.
Probably the most disappointing. A lot of good things about the film. It certainly raised awareness about the issue. In the midterm of 2022, there were patriots in Arizona camping by the drop boxes with their cell phones. They're like, okay, if any mules show up, we're ready for them. You know, so people are aware of this method of cheating. But I think what disappointed me was that there are many mainstream Republicans, including some who are conservative. These aren't rhinos. And they were afraid to watch the film. It's not that they watched the film and go, I'm not convinced. They didn't want to see the film because they didn't want to be convinced. They were like, if I watch the film, I'm going to have to do something about it. But if I do something about it, I'm going to be called an election denier. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be called an election denier, a conspiracy theorist. I want to be seen as respectable. And so there was almost a kind of prudent avoidance of the film, even among members of the Republican establishment.
Right. What is that? I mean, just from a personal standpoint, the lack of moral courage. I mean, how does that? You were talking to me the other night about politics and how people go off to Washington with all these, you know, sincere and genuine motives to try to help, and then they get bought out by some lobbyist or they get a huge donation to their PAC. I mean, we talk on this show a lot about just the courage. Like, where is the moral courage to just, as you say, see the evidence and then do something about it? So many of them don't want to even look at the evidence because they don't want to do anything about it.
Human beings are by and large very conformist. And almost all the rhetoric that we hear about independent thought applies only to a few people. College students, for example, like to think of themselves as independent thinkers. They're making up their own minds. But the truth of it is, you can take any cause, climate change, the ozone layer, Gaza, and not only pick any cause, you can rotate the cause. You can say, for the next 6 weeks, it's going to be Gaza, and after that, we're going to go climate change. And you'll see this, quote, herd of independent thinkers thoughtlessly move from one to the other. And what are they moving in tune with? The drummer. Mm-hmm. The drummer is the approval of the surrounding culture. Not American culture, but the campus culture. And similarly, what happens with guys who go to Washington is that Washington is its own village. It's like the ancient village. Now, in the ancient village, the last thing you want would be, you know, gossipy women, where every time you walk down the street, you go, look at that guy, you know, he's a creep, you know, and think of how awkward that would make you feel, because that's your whole life, that village. The media creates the same environment in Washington, D.C. for congressmen and senators. It's a village. They're, oh, watch that guy, he's a real creep. So the Republicans live in terror that they don't want to be that guy. And the way you avoid being that guy is that you maintain a conservative portfolio. You certainly campaign on a conservative portfolio, but you don't go too far. And the going too far, the parameters of that is set by the media. So the two taboo topics, election fraud is one of them, and that's a taboo. January 6th is the other one. And so sure enough, there are a lot of conservatives, good guys for the most part, but they won't touch those two issues.
And I think this is what really sets apart, and you touched on this in your public address the other night, it's what sets Donald Trump apart. He brings up topics, he goes there when others are too afraid, they don't want to go there. Maybe you could talk, we kind of discussed last night some of the differences between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, but how is Donald Trump a man for the times that we're in at this moment?
With Reagan, the dividing line was between the United States and the Soviet Union. So the threat was coming from abroad. And that gave Reagan a certain unifying posture in the United States because the enemy was over there. With Trump, the situation has changed completely. Our greatest threats are from within. Putin is much less of a danger just to my, not just my rights, my basic security. If I am concerned that a group of militarized thugs will show up at my door and kill me, and I'm not even speaking metaphorically here, and I had to check a box as to who that's most likely to be, I would check the box that said the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Our own FBI is most likely to do, I'm not saying it's, that they're going to do that, but I'm saying if I had to compare, is it going to be, you know, Putin? Is it going to be an Iranian terrorist? Or is it going to be the FBI? I check confidently the FBI. So think of what that tells you. That's a different America. Oh, yeah. Trump knows that. Many other Republicans know that, but they have the mentality, I mentioned this in my lecture, of the wildebeest, where they want to be, they could define success as being eaten last by the lion.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you, what's your take on the Trump phenomenon? He's, you know, they've tried to destroy him every step of the way. And, you know, if you listen to Scarborough and company, they all said he was finished, you know, years ago. You know, Mr. Trump, I mean, what does it tell you about the man's courage and his resilience and his willingness to make sacrifices for the United States?
Well, he is one of those, once in a generation, maybe even once in a lifetime type of figures that appears on the scene. There's no one kind of like him. He has no ancestors. You can't say he's in the tradition of so-and-so. He isn't. I don't think that when he leaves the scene, there will be anyone like him for a long time, if ever. So he is, in that sense, unique. He also has, and the left is right about this, a certain kind of talismanic or transcendent type of power. So when they say he's an insurrectionist, he's actually not. He didn't call for an insurrection. There was no insurrection on January 6th. But he is one of the few people who could have. He could have called for an insurrection. There would have been one. He could still do it. If Trump were to say now that America is in a state of civil war and people need to pile up on weapons and they need to recognize the situation, people would do those things. No one else has that kind of power. Biden can't call an insurrection, and Lindsey Graham can't call an insurrection. It would be a joke. So Trump, in that sense, is sui generis. He's in his own category. And therefore, I'm almost speechless when I hear people say things like, you know, well, I don't really know if I could bring myself to vote for him because I don't like his temperament. And I don't like his tweets. We're not, this, such a statement reveals you to be a petty person with no sense of the overall stakes. It's kind of like someone who would say, to give you an analogy, if someone were to say, well, I really am not that comfortable with General Grant. You know, I hear that he ran his father's store into the ground and he was kind of a drunk and a womanizer. You know, the point is you're in a civil war.
Right.
You know, this is the guy who's taking the fight to Lee. This is the guy who will assure Lincoln of his reelection in 1864. And you're talking this kind of nonsense
right
at this late stage? This is I literally get not triggered, but I'm like, I cannot even grasp your pettiness and lack of perspective in uttering such idiocies in such a troubling time for the country. If you said these things in 1986, I would laugh. But for you to say them now is a very bad reflection on you.
Yeah, it's a different time.
Yeah.
So your film that you're producing this year, you said the other night you want Donald Trump to be featured prominently in the story. What are you hoping to get out of him as far as the interview for the film is concerned?
Well, I want to do a kind of an in-depth conversation with Trump, but I want to bring out a side of Trump that I think has not been shown to the American people. When I look at political figures that I've crossed paths with, I find that some of them are the same in public as they are in private. A good example is Reagan. If we had Reagan sitting right here, he would sound exactly like the public Reagan you've seen on TV. You know, well, Dinesh, you know, we give it the good, you know, I think that we had a revolution and it's been a success and America's best days are ahead. Reagan in public and Reagan in private are identical. With Trump, that's not the case. Trump in public is, and the reason I actually laugh when I say this is it's actually even true of me in my own way. Because people will say, you know, and my wife sometimes goes, she goes, Dinesh, she goes, you are just so like ruthless and savage on Twitter, you know, on X. She goes, it's not like you at all. She goes, in person, you're not confrontational. You know, you don't like degrade people and attack them. She goes, and I go, honey, I go, that's my Twitter persona. I go, that is, I'm not saying that that's not me. It's one part of me. And it's partly dictated not just by me, it's dictated by the medium. It's kind of like, Dinesh at the tennis court is going to be different than Dinesh lost in the jungle, you know. So Twitter is more like the Wild West, you know. Everyone's like that.
Right.
And so you have to, that's the way you fight in that domain. Now, on the other hand, if I'm debating somebody on a stage, I'll follow the etiquette and, you know, Mr. Chairman, may I interject? And,
right.
You know, I'll play by the Oxford rules because that's the format.
Right.
So with Trump, there is a whole side of Trump that I think would be very interesting and disarming to Americans to see. I've got to bring it out of him.
Right.
Because it's actually not his style of doing interviews. His style of doing interviews is you ask him a question, he speaks for 20 minutes straight. And he's got certain things that are like that are bothering him and he wants to get them off his chest. As opposed to a more controlled format where I'm trying to get him to answer very precise questions and let me control the agenda. That's not easy, so that's going to be the challenge.
No, you've got your work cut out for you.
For sure, for sure.
We'll look forward to that that film as it comes out later this year. So there's so much to get to. I want to talk just a little bit about your visit on campus. You've been with us for a couple of days here. Your first experience with us was to get the guided tour through the Kingdom of David and Solomon exhibit. You mentioned the other day that you are going to be working on a film next year about Israel. So, tell us what led to our conversation. Initially was a podcast you did on archaeology and you interviewed a man that we're mutual friends with. And what's your reaction to just the exhibit we have at Armstrong Auditorium?
Remarkable. I mean, an amazing and highly informative. You know, you don't know what to expect. I got a letter from you guys about the fact that you had done some work with a prominent Israeli archaeologist whose work I'm interested in because she is she's dead now, but her work was, you could call it biblical archaeology.
Right.
And biblical archaeology essentially takes the Bible on the one side and the findings of secular archaeology on the other and holds them up one against the other to compare. There are archaeologists who do work, and they don't do that. They're not interested in the Bible, per se. They're just like, I found a stone. It's from this period. This is what it means. But a biblical archaeologist will say, in the Book of Kings, it says that there was a tall mountain, and it says that beyond the mountain were some orchards, and then beyond this were the people, you know, let's just say the Canaanites. And so it's interesting to look at archaeology. Well, what does archaeology say about where's that mountain? And what's beyond it? And were, in fact, the people who lived beyond that the Canaanites? So in other words, is the Bible giving you an accurate description of the time and the place and the who and the and, or is the Bible a sort of a loose sort of collection of moral fables, not without value, but nevertheless not talking about real people and real places and real times. So this to me is the great importance of biblical archaeology. In any event, I knew that you had an exhibit on the Solomon and David period, but I didn't know what was in it. And boy, did I learn a lot. And I've taken a booklet, which I'm going to study very carefully, because there's just so much there.
Yeah. Yeah, you alluded to the late Dr. Alat Mazar. She famously started her excavations into the City of David by looking at a scripture in, I think it's 2 Samuel 5, where it says when the Jebusites were on the attack, you know, headed to Jerusalem, that King David went down to the fortress. So there was the Jebusite fortress, and David was, engaged in building a new palace for him. And just that one word, down, she's like, okay, the palace had to have been situated higher up the hill of the City of David. So, and she had this article in Biblical Archaeology Review from 1997 where she had a picture of the City of David and then this red arrow that said, this is where the palace is, just let me dig, just give me the funding and the support and we'll start digging. And she did, and sure enough, she discovers this Davidic wall and a couple of bullae along the way.
You know, I was at the Palace of David in December of 2022, and we're getting kind of a tour. And as you go at the top of the ruins, the top of the palace, you look across, there's a hillside below. And even now, you have all these homes scattered across the hillside. And the homes typically built in that style have terraces. And I was thinking about the passage about David and Bathsheba, which on the face of it, when you read it, knowing nothing about any of this, is odd. Here's David, he's in the palace. He looks out and he sees a woman, apparently semi-nude or nude, bathing.
Right?
But this is odd because by and large, if a woman is taking a bath, she's not gonna be doing it in the place where she's gonna be visible. And yet, what's interesting is that you now begin to understand that in a low-lying area, if you're up on a terrace, for example, you're not visible. But you're not visible except to one person. And that is the guy who is in the palace that is built at the highest point, who can actually see right down and see you straight. So suddenly, the whole David Bathsheba incident makes complete sense. You can see how it happened. And it kind of brings you to the scene of the event. I think that, you know, as a guy who's a movie maker, I mean, there is a, that's what you try to do in film. You try to bring someone to the scene of the event. And you can't make a good movie that doesn't do that. So I find archaeology coming to life in a very powerful way. And I also think that in this secular age, this type of apologetics, if you will, for the authenticity of the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures is perhaps the best way to go.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the story with David and Bathsheba, because I had a conversation with Dr. Mazar as we were talking about where the palace was situated, and I brought that up. I said, well, that also makes perfect sense. If he's high up in the palace, that he could have seen, you know, Bathsheba. And then she was not religious at all. But she sees the Old Testament as her history book. I mean, this is the history of her people. So anyway, when I brought up Bathsheba, she's like, oh, you Christians, you always want to get into the teachings and what happened and this or that, you know, and she just wanted to know the archaeology. And I said, well, still the picture, as you say, if you're producing a film, all of a sudden you see it. You know, you see, yeah, this is, if we could put this to video, it tells the story. And of course, you know, we believe all the stories are true, as well as the geography and, you know, where things were situated, you know, as far as archaeology is concerned.
We had a guide who was a Messianic Jew, a guy who was a believer in Jesus, but nevertheless kept all the Jewish customs. And in fact, his father was a rabbi. And he was talking to us about, in Israel, about the folded clothes that the women found at the tomb. There's a reference to some folded cloths and robes. And to anyone reading the incident now, it would be like, oh, that's interesting. You got some folded clothes, when the tomb is empty and there are these folded clothes. But what this guy says, he goes, listen, he goes, in Jewish culture, these things have a lot of significance. So he goes, take my dad. He goes, my dad's a rabbi. He often has a get-together and he brings a whole bunch of people together, scholars or people who are visiting. And he says, it's quite possible in the middle of the meal or the middle of the meeting, my dad will take these cloths that are this tablecloth or the serviettes and so on, and he will fold them, put them in a stack, and then just walk out. Or at other times, he might take the cloths and not fold them and just toss them on the table and walk out. And he goes, those two things have a completely different meaning. Because if my dad folds the cloths and puts them in one corner and leaves, that implies that he's returning. And in fact, no one gets up to leave because that's the meaning of the folded cloths. If on the other hand, my dad tosses it on the table, it means we're done, we can all leave. So now take just that simple, tiny nugget of Jewish customary practice and apply it to the folded clothes in the tomb. Mm-hmm. And you get a completely different look at it, different way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Now, again, if you're not, you want to just dismiss it out of hand, you can, but I don't think you can deny that there's something interesting going on and that, even remove it from a religious context. If I was talking about Hamlet and someone told me about folded clothes and gave me this, I would be like, that's interesting. I'm going to write an essay on that because that changes the traditional or naive meaning of the text and it throws a new light on it. Same here.
So coming back to your film, you said you want archaeology to tell part of that story. What is the premise of the documentary you're going to be doing next year on Israel?
The film is, if I did a film on just biblical archaeology, it might seem to be for specialists or aimed at a niche audience. So the film is on Israel, terrorism, anti-Semitism. It will tie in what's going on over there with things going on in the campus and in the street over here. So it is, in that sense, a film very much tied to current events. However, in discussing this, a film always needs to step back and ask, what is this fight all about? And the core question at the heart of it, I think, is whose land is it? Who does this piece of land belong to? And to answer that question, it is not irrelevant to say, well, who used to live here and when? And so biblical archaeology is a way of bringing in that discussion. So I see this film as a political film, but with a very interesting dimension of Jewish and Christian apologetics, because it is, to quote one of your brochures, it's letting the stones speak.
Right.
Let people draw both political conclusions and perhaps even spiritual ones.
Yeah, sounds great. Yesterday, well, following your guided tour, you then were nice enough to sit in on Celtic Throne, another Celtic Throne performance. Do you guys have the clip of him backstage? If so, you can play that.
I did not expect it. It was great. How long have you guys been working on this? A while. But it shows. Your son. Look at you little guys. You're amazing. You're all great performers. And smiling too. Well, congratulations on an amazing performance. I'm delighted to be part of it. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming.
So you told me that you and your wife enjoy going out for opera or Broadway shows. What was your reaction to Celtic Throne?
I mean, I was really thrilled. I enjoyed it, watching it. It was varied. It was the music was fantastic. The dancing was memorable and great. It was fun to see. I wouldn't say all ages, but really from, I would say, what is it, age 2 to age 3, all the way up to maybe 20-somethings performing. and at a very high quality. I mean, it was, you felt like this was a, you know, this could have been a Broadway performance. It was just beautifully done. I was kind of wishing my wife was there because she loves music, she loves dance. She's actually, she used to be a dancer at one time. She's made movies, she's sung in our movies, right. Debbie has. And no, I think it's it was just a beautiful evocation of a time and a place, and just great Irish music and dance.
Well, the, I know the kids got a thrill with you coming backstage, and yeah, they're all homegrown. They all train right here on campus, and they're all about to hit the road to dance in.
Well, you know, you're invited to a campus. Typically, you're expecting to see a kind of a school level or maybe college level performance, and not something where you got, you know, some of the top dancers in the world performing. And I think that's what took me aback, is I saw at least, you know, three or four of the male dancers, and I'm like, you guys could, I don't know if you are professionals, but you easily could be, you're that good.
Mm-hmm. Well, we appreciate you viewing that, and you can bring your wife back next time, and hopefully she can take a look at it as well.
That would be great.
I just want to finish on a few personal notes, I guess. I kind of told you about this the other night, but yeah, your impact, just your writings on me personally back in the 1990s, I have to say, forgive me, I was probably more avidly reading your writings then. I was coming out of college, I didn't quite finish college, and I knew you were into not just current events and things of that nature, but you were also, you know, a product of higher education here in the United States. And so, yeah, some of the early writings, I mentioned that book, The End of Racism. I think that was 1995. Fantastic book. I was scouring the house and my office for it. I don't know what happened to it, but I'm going to go get another copy. I had it all marked up and everything. But then right around that same time, you had the biography on Ronald Reagan, on leadership. And then, too, I was always fascinated by your book, Illiberal Education, where, you know, you talked about how in modern education today, you know, students will come into the campus and they're sold a bill of goods on, it's a tolerant atmosphere, you're all coming together. But what you pointed out is that really what happens once they get to the campus is it's a very polarized environment, and they go and they sort of associate with their group. And maybe it's been a long time since you wrote that, but What have you seen in just higher education today that, given how involved you were with Dartmouth way back when, and then just the differences today with all these campus protests and everything else where the colleges, it seems, they're churning out people that are just feeding on propaganda?
Yeah, that's the point, is that things have gotten, I think, sadly, a lot worse. In a way, you could almost say that there's no more polarization, in the sense that the polarization ends when conformity begins. So think, for example, about, you know, you have a Marxist revolution in a country. It's polarized because you have people for it, against it. But once the Marxists have crushed everybody else, then they establish uniformity. Then there's no real polarization. Or if there's polarization, people are internal dissidents, but they can't speak up. That's what's happened on the campus. The conservatives are now tiny pockets. Conservative professors, by and large, never say what they are. They keep quiet. They're in hiding, really. And it's like in Hollywood, where you've got a group of conservatives, and they have a group that they belong to, but they meet in secret because it would ruin their careers if their identities were known. So this is a sign of, not of a free society, but a kind of, these are elements of unfree societies. And the campus is, but when I think back on Illiberal Education, came out in 91 and then in paperback in 92, it identified a phenomenon that is still recognizable to us. The fact that campuses, if you look at their catalogs, you see liberal education. If you are on the campus, you see illiberal education, the exact opposite, a repudiation of all the principles of liberal education. So our campuses are really no longer campuses in the original meaning of the term. Education in its normal sense is not what happens there. I'm not saying that there's no education that occurs, but it's subordinate to politics, subordinate to ideology. I'm very lucky in my career that both my first book, Illiberal Education, and my first film, Obama's America, were huge successes mm-hmm. because it paved the way for me to have a career as an author for many years and then a career as a filmmaker. And so, in other words, it's from a career point of view, it is very fortunate to, it's kind of like going out on the baseball field and hitting a home run the first shot.
Yeah.
It sets you up for a lot of subsequent games.
Yeah. How long as a student and then an administrator were you at Dartmouth?
I was never an administrator there. I was just a student from 1979 to 83. I graduated in 83. I then went to Princeton where I worked for a magazine before coming to Washington to work for another magazine called Policy Review. Then I joined the Reagan White House for 2 years, and then I spent about 20 years in two prominent think tanks or research foundations, the American Enterprise Institute and the Hoover Institution. So although I've been in quasi-academic institutions most of my life, it's not as a professor. It's more like a research scholar and an author.
Yeah. Did you see a strong Marxist influence when you were there as a student?
A strong leftist influence that is shaped by Marxism, although not exclusively by Marxism. Leftist influences was also shaped by a lot of things that tied into Marxism but weren't explicitly Marxist. So, for example, the idea that the world is running out of resources. It's not a Marxist idea, but it can tie into because it leads to Marxist-type solutions.
Right.
Or even climate change. There's nothing inherently Marxist about climate change, but it's used by Marxists to advance their agenda. And by and large, I think I encounter the paradox of the highly affluent student on these campuses where you want for nothing. And I was actually struck coming from India. Wow, I mean, in India, by and large, if you want to go play tennis, you know, there's a long line for the tennis court. You have to sign up, wait for your turn, because there's one court. Then I go to Dartmouth, and there's like tennis courts as far as the eye can see, and most of them are like empty. Just take a ball and go start playing. And I was like, wow. And then I go into these big reading rooms, and, you know, they're, first of all, Dartmouth's in New Hampshire, so it's very cold in the winter, but these are like heated all night, and they've got like coffee and donuts. And I was like, this is a level of abundance that it just took me aback. Even by the standard of American abundance, it was at another level. And so these kids have everything. And therefore, it's so odd and so pathological and perverted for me to see these kids. And they're like, they want to be like the Gazans, but they're not like the Gazans, you know? So what do? They're like, I'll take over a building and then I'll claim I have no food. The dining hall is actually open and so are all these restaurants. And I can actually be eating in any of them right now. But no, I go barricade myself in a building. Please give me water. Please give me food. I'm like the Gazans. You know, this is like role playing. It's fantasy, and it's fantasy of a twisted sort.
Yeah. So when you went to Dartmouth, you went right into the school newspaper. Is that right?
I did. And then we actually started a rebel conservative newspaper, a bunch of us, called the Dartmouth Review.
So how did you, for such a young man at the time, and you came over as an exchange student to Arizona, even in your high school days, but what is it that shaped your worldview early on to where you were pretty conservative, you know, straight away?
Yeah, I think what it was is that there were a group of upperclassmen, older guys, who I kind of fell into their group. And I noticed that they were extremely well-read outside of the classroom. So they would be like, well, as Adam Smith once put it, and well, as Friedrich Hayek notes in his latest, in his book on the industrial society, and Solzhenitsyn, Margaret Thatcher, and Adam Smith, Ricardo, Keynes, Hayek, this was their currency. They spoke about this kind. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I mean, I'm 18, but you guys are only 20. Like, what are you talking about? Like, who told you to read all these books? What do these books even say? So I began to immerse myself in learning about these things. And then what comes into view for me is a conservative philosophy. And I go, wow, that is actually what I've always believed. In other words, I didn't become a conservative. I came to the awareness that this was an elaborated explanation for things that I already held to be true. It's kind of like you believe that 2 + 2 = 4 because you're taught that as a kid. But later you actually see a proof. Right. And you're like, oh wow, 2 + 2 actually indeed is 4. But not just because I saw 2 apples here and 2 apples over there and then I counted, I got 4. But that there's actually a logical underpinning for something that I thought before, but now I see the full kind of intellectual fortification for that.
Right. Well, that's a perfect lead into the last question, I promise. Where, as you know, there's a small liberal arts college here on this church campus. And what, I mean, being in academia to the extent that you were and just all the work you've done since that time with books and films, what would you tell a group of 19-year-olds as far as just preparing them for life and being like educated, you know, having a broad education like those older students that you met way back in the day? Any, given the course that higher education is on, and it's a pretty bad one, what would you tell a group of young students as to, this is what I would suggest to prepare you best for life?
Yeah, I think that for me, at Dartmouth, I caught a certain type of a bug, and that bug, I believe, is the germ of true education. That bug is the bug that, as an adult or as a young adult, takes you back to when you were 3 years old. And the world was a wondrous and a strange place in which nothing was, quote, normal. Everything sort of needed to have an explanation. Like, why does this guy have only one eye? And why is, why are there tides? Why does the ocean come out and then go back? And so there is this naive curiosity that we have as kids. But very often those questions are not really addressed. Partly because the adults that we ask them to don't know the answer. So we learn to drop those questions. And then we go off to college and we never go back to basic curiosity questions. Instead, what we do is we now go into what I would call systematic learning. So systematic learning would be, I'm going to now tell you what Plato believed. But the truth of it is, who cares what Plato believed? You know, in other words, it's not important for me to know this is what Plato believed, and this is what Aristotle believed, and this is what Kant believed, and this is... No, what's really interesting to me is to take a question that is a real question in the world. And the only reason we go to Plato is he had an interesting way to look at that question to show me something where I go, whoa, I didn't think of that. In philosophy, to take a very simple example, we always assume in normal life, and philosophers have assumed for centuries, that when you take in the world as it is and the world as it is pictured in your mind are the same. So in other words, your mind is like a camera. It looks at the world, I look at the ocean, and now obviously the physical ocean doesn't come into my head, so my mind is making a picture of the ocean. And I assume, and I naively assume, and there's no other way to operate, I go, the picture that I see of the ocean in my head is the same as the ocean. But if you actually think about it, it's actually hard to know that, right? Because we know, first of all, in many cases, we see things, let's say you see a mirage, or you see an oasis, you know, and the oasis turns out not to be there as you approach it closer, or you look at a stick in the water and it looks bent, even though it has to, you know, it's a straight stick, you just put it in there yourself. So even though you know that your senses can deceive you, we always operate with the assumption that the world as it is and the world as we experience it are the same. So along comes a philosopher, in this case it happens to be Immanuel Kant, and he goes, no, you know, the world as we experience it is a product of the world, but it's also a product of our minds acting upon the world. So what we're getting is a hybrid experience that combines the thing out there and combines our mind. But that combination is different than the thing in itself. And we've always kind of known that, but until Kant points it out, we don't really see it. We've always known, for example, let's just say I pick up something and I smell it, and I go, oh, that smells horrible, right? We can always ask the question, is the smell in the thing or is it in me? Where's the smell coming from? In other words, is the smell the product of my faculties of smelling something, or is there something in the chemicals, in the physical object that creates smell? What is it? You know, this kind of thing. So I'm saying education is all about taking our experience in the world, and I would say the most important thing is never to lose that sense of naive, childlike curiosity. The greatest of all discoverers and philosophers have had that thing. That's the common thing they've all had. And they're able to ask a crazy question, and exploring that question brings them to their great discovery, you know?
Yeah.
So with Einstein, for example, it's sort of like, here's a light beam, right? And it's going at its tremendous speed. What if I could actually get in a spaceship and ride alongside the light beam, go right alongside it, and then I measure the speed of light? What number would I get? That's Einstein's asking this exact question. But the perversity of Einstein, or the genius of Einstein, is to ask the question. Once you ask the question, interesting answers begin to suggest themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you begin to think like this. You begin to think, well, okay, well, if I was in a train and it's going 20 miles an hour, and here's another train going 40 miles an hour, if I had a speed stick, I would measure 20. Because I'm going at 20, and the train is going at 40. But Einstein realized that if light is traveling, and I'm going alongside light, and I measure the speed of light, that speed of light will never change, even if I'm going alongside it. And once you see that, you're like, something very strange is happening here. And I now need to like rethink the whole way I think about space and time. So I try to bring this kind of wide curiosity to politics.
Yeah.
And that's different than a lot of other people. And so people who like my work generally have this aspect of it appeals to them.
So maintain that childlike curiosity.
Right. Yes.
Dinesh D'Souza, thanks for joining us on today's show.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stephen Fleury and Dinesh D'Souza, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you again tomorrow.